Hey, what's up, everybody? It's your boy, Christopher Terrence Jones. Welcome to another episode of the Christopher Terrence Jones Show. Can we talk? How are you guys doing? Hope all is well. You know what's going on. Social distancing. That's where we are, y'all. Make sure that you are doing that. And you know what to do right now. Share the podcast. Don't keep it to yourself. Share, share, and share alike. Tell a friend. Tell a friend. Tell a friend. Make sure that you're washing your hands as well. And remember, just because they gave you $1,200 doesn't mean that you're supposed to be outside. Stay your butt in the house till this thing passes, because it's not over. COVID-19 is here and is going to be the new norm. So on this week's episode, I contacted this handsome man across the country, and I follow him on social media, and I think his posts are really enlightening and very fundamental for reading, because y'all know, I say reading is fundamental. So you need to follow somebody that you can get some edumacation from. And that's what I do, so that I learn a little something along the way, even though when we always reading all this other smut, we do learn something along the way. So I want you guys to welcome Larry Bryant Jr. to the show, all the way from Washington, D.C. Hello, sir.
Hello, good afternoon.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Let me say thank you again for agreeing to come on the show and have this conversation. You're amazing. That's what I mean. Freaking amazing.
Thank you. Hopefully at the end of this, I won't do anything to burst that bubble. So
I'm not worried. I'm not worried. So everybody at home, you know, there's so many things going on in the news, and you know that we're having protests, and the protests are leading to ideas that we should defund the police department. Mm-hmm. That is the conversation that is going on in the world right now. Now, I want you guys to know that this is not new. This conversation has been had before, but nothing has ever transpired. But the conversation is now the hot topic. And as I tell y'all before, if I don't know something, I'm gonna get somebody else who can come on and talk about it and help you understand it. And I thought that it would just be time to have a great conversation about this. So I went and found someone who could do it better than me. They could do it justice, and you can learn from somebody. So first off, I just want Larry Bryant to tell everybody just a little bit about himself, and y'all will see his handsome picture on Instagram. He's very handsome. Y'all will see that. Stay out of his dang inbox. Y'all know that. But tell the people about you.
So, again, my name is Larry Bryant. I live here in Washington, D.C. I'm actually a D.C. native. Was born here. My parents are from here. Went to high school across the river in Alexandria, Virginia. T.C. Williams, Remember the Titans. And I grew up in Air Force Brigade. I lived a lot of different places. Most recently, I was living in Brooklyn, working with the National Alliance for Mental Illness there as a support programs coordinator. I was in Brooklyn for about 6 years, and I had, I guess, a couple of moments of clarity, I guess, that I needed to come back home to be a part of my city and to do advocacy work. I was a little kind of a step away from direct advocacy with NAMI. And I got a call basically from the ACLU, the DC. And I thought, you know, this is a great opportunity to do this kind of work, social justice, civil rights work in my hometown, the place I was born. So I'm back here in DC. Now, I didn't foresee all of these things happening last February when I started with the ACLU DC, but I think I'm where I need to be, considering the topics and the pushes for reform that we want to see happen here in the city and, of course, across the country.
Amazing. Amazing. So, DC native. So, You were there when DC was known as Chocolate City.
Yeah. Chocolate City growing up, a little less so in the last 10, 20 years, largely because of gentrification. DC is, if not the fastest gentrified major city in the country, it's among the top. Properties and neighborhoods have been remade, developed into something other than just chocolate. And a large part of that is developers. A large part of that is DC has been a transient city. There's a lot of universities here, so you got students that are in and out. You have politicians who are in and out from around the country. But a lot of people aren't completely, if you've never been to the city of DC, aren't familiar that there's actually a city of neighborhoods that have existed around the Capitol, around the white marble buildings downtown for years, for decades. And there are people, the city has transformed tremendously over the years. And that transformation, that prosperity, of course, you can say the same thing in the East Bay and other places as it looks across to San Francisco, that transformation and progress doesn't happen equally. And a lot of that same thing is happening here.
Exactly. So that, I never thought to ask somebody, but this is my question now. So that's a good one. It made me think of that. How is it living? So like here in the Bay Area, we're predominantly Democrats. California is like predominantly Democrat country. But living in DC, where there's so many, you get independents, you get Democrats, you get Republicans. How is that living when there's so many different political views going on?
Well, DC, the votership in DC, if you're a DC resident, it's largely Democratic. It's 85% plus, like the literal residents of the city are mostly Democrat. Like we just recently had the primaries for city council members here in DC, and generally, whether it's for city council, for mayor, if you run Democrat, you win your primary, you essentially win. Like whatever happens in November is more symbolic than anything. So the city of DC has been Democratic for as long as I can remember. Now, it makes for an interesting kind of interaction when you have a president, for example, that's not a Democrat. Wow. So it becomes a little bit of a challenge there. And for the most part, the presidents have had kind of a fair interaction with the surrounding city, despite that. They have their local restaurants and places they'll go for entertainment, et cetera. This president, not so much. Our previous president, President Barack Obama, I think they still live here, or at least they still own a home here. Their daughters go to school here. So here in the city, it's Democratic, but it's also, as we know, within the Democratic Party, within just, the philosophy of how politics goes and how personal politics enters into whatever your designation is, they're still conservative-minded people here, even though they're Democrat. There might be progressive on the bigger scale, but you still have pockets of the city who are either white or elevated in the socioeconomic status, liberals who don't necessarily go beyond, in the Anacostia River into Southeast and understand, the politics or the policies of how people, of what change really means. I mean, there is kind of this progressive bubble that exists in parts of the city where people have the dog parks and their, bicycle lanes and, the biggest things on their minds are, is my trash getting picked up on time? And so things are good until things aren't. And it's been an interesting transformation in the city now. It's not just enough to, and we've heard the term, online and other places, it's not enough just to be not racist. You have to be anti-racist.
Right.
And there, even though we're a city, it's a relatively small city, 700,000 or so people in our district, still larger than a couple of states, but it's a very kind of a tight knit, like you bump up against people and you feel pain. You feel the pain. And it's also additionally complicated because we are the nation's capital. So, and it may not be as much now because of the COVID-19 pandemic, but a lot of the protests and the marches that happen downtown are people from everywhere else. People from all over the country, people from all over the world. I used to kind of use this metaphor, like DC is sometimes like the customer service desk at Walmart. If anyone on the planet has a complaint, they come to the capital of the free world to make that complaint known. And so it's been interesting to see some of the marches and some of the reactions in the last few weeks from our marchers, protesters, and from just people in the city who are actually kind of claiming participation in this movement and not just kind of watching from the windows and their doorsteps.
So you just told me something. And I guess because I've never taken the time to just find out, I really did not know that DC was a Democratic place. Oh, I have new hope for the city now.
Well, and on that point, you know, in the last, it's been years now as well that DC has been fighting for statehood. Like I said, DC has a population larger than Montana, I believe in Montana, has a population larger than Rhode Island or Delaware, I can't remember. But there's two or three states that DC is larger than.
People-wise. Yeah, 700,000 people, that's a lot of people.
Right. Well, when you have Republican leadership in Congress, in the Senate, they are not going to advocate for DC being a state, knowing that they're just going to add two Democratic senators to the mix. The biggest challenge one of the biggest obstacles for DC in becoming a state is kind of having people outside the city talk to, like, learn about the makeup of who DC is and what is benefited if and when DC becomes a state. And it's literally along political lines. I mean, obviously the Senate is, again, ruled by Republicans now, currently, is not going to allow that. The House of Representatives voted, like, they are in favor of statehood here in DC. So we are closer than we've ever been to that. If and when the turnover happens in the Senate side of Congress, then it's almost a done deal that DC will become a state. But then internally, it's also about kind of addressing the inner dynamic. There's a lot of locals here that are concerned, I guess is the word, of what statehood means. There's already the economic disparities here. There's health disparities mostly along racial socioeconomic lines. Does statehood then further support that push, that high gentrification push I talked about earlier, where the city is no longer Chocolate City, it's kind of being remade into a new DC. And there are locals, natives, Washingtonians who have been here who are a little more wary about having that transformation happen, because it might push them further and further away from actual representation. There's a lot of cheerleaders here. Most of the DC-based advocacy groups for statehood are led primarily by white faces and white voices. Well-meaning, well, white faces and white voices, but white faces and white voices nonetheless. Which do not necessarily represent the communities in Ward 7, Ward 8, the communities that are far more historically deep when it comes to blackness in the city. So,
wow. And so I guess, and I'm glad you said that too, because I never I don't know. You always just think when you say DC, you think state, but it's really the District of Columbia. And so you don't think about the fact that, oh, they're not really. So, you know, it just, you never think about it because you go on your day-to-day lives.
Yeah. Well, especially outside the city. I will give you that.
Oh,
outside.
Yeah. Let me say that. For those of us that don't live there.
Yeah.
Those of us
that don't live there. Hopefully, I know I've talked to some of the advocacy groups here in D.C., staff that are in our mayor's office and city council, even our representative in the House of Representatives, in the House of Representatives, Eleanor Holmes Norton, about what we can do internally within the city to help kind of educate and really kind of bite-sized bits of information, like how does statehood affect the everyday life of the average Washingtonian, you know, versus now. Because people need the big concept of waving the flag and say, yeah, it all sounds great, but we know what the waving of the flag means. Right. But how does it affect, how does moving to a state impact our, you know, the daily life of a mother of three, you know, trying to make ends meet, or, you know, taking their kids to school, working every day, you know, 9 to 5, and connected to the average social services, housing, counseling services, or whatever programs necessary just to keep afloat every day. Does statehood affect, you know, help her? Or is it just something that we collectively cheer on, like we did last year with the Nationals winning the World Series, that everyone kind of connects to, but then the parade's done and then we all go back to our corners of the city. So we need to have really kind of meaningful examples to everyone in the city what that progress means. I was born here. I hope to one day see DC become a state. But I also want it to be what it needs to be for everybody, not just this kind of thing where I can say, where was I when this happened? You know, I want to see that change impact everyone, and everyone that in the city has a voice to be able to make that happen.
Wow. So that would be something. That definitely would be something. So you guys are learning a lot today, because I'm learning a lot. I'm telling y'all, I'm learning a lot. He's telling me, baby, I'm learning a lot today. So when it comes to, you know, we always, we're hearing it now in conversation when we say defund the police, and defund the police comes after so many protests and all of this. What does protesting, I know in other areas it looks different, because protesting in Oakland is like the hotbed. They don't go to San Francisco, they go to Oakland. For some unknown reason, Oakland is the spot where they just decide we're going to go right here and protest. And I don't know if it has to do that the Black Panthers were started here, if they feel that that's all right, because they were here, we can come. And 14th and Broadway is always the center spot for any protest that starts in Oakland. And so what does protesting look like there compared to what it looks like in other places? Because that's how we got to the conversations again about defunding police, right? Because of the riots, the looting, the police brutality at the protest.
So that's an interesting question. So I live in the Columbia Heights part of DC. It's kind of, you know, a mile and a half, 2 miles from the White House, from like the center of DC. And I live across the street from, if you look on the map, it says Meridian Hill Park. But it is unofficially known as Malcolm X Park, because back during the Civil Rights Movement, and even maybe before that, this area was, and the park was kind of central for a lot of planning around racial justice issues, around civil rights, social justice issues. It was just that kind of spot. And for the riots, in the 60s, after Martin Luther King was killed, there was riots in 67, 68 that happened on U Street, where, you know, it was kind of the first or one of the first pushes. In fact, it happened all over the country. I remember the movie Detroit came out a couple years ago, and it was centered around those riots and racial justice uprisings that happened in Detroit and kind of their interactions with, surprise, surprise, racist police there. A lot of that happened here. But since George Floyd's murder in Minneapolis, there were marches around the city. And I remember that Friday, I can't remember the exact date, it must have been like one of the last weekend of May, I believe. Right here, 14th and U, there was a march and kind of just a crowd gathering, like enough is enough. You know, we need to stop killing unarmed Black men in our country. This came weeks after Ahmaud Arbery, after Breonna Taylor. Now, obviously, Ahmaud Arbery wasn't killed by police, but it was the same racist element that was involved. And so it became the rallies, the anger, and the protests were more kind of centralized in neighborhoods. Largely because DC has its own history, like very recent history of unarmed Black men, young Black men being killed by our local police department. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these rallies and marches and protests and the language you're hearing now existed in DC long before George Floyd. It just ascended quickly at that point, and the volume was turned up everywhere. And then I guess the attention shifted to the White House because of who's in it and things that he was saying about, you know, if they start looting, we start shooting kind of language. Wow. And so a lot of the anger, especially in the city, this goes back to your earlier question about how does a mostly Democrat affiliated city interact with a president in this case, who is not. And so it's been kind of an uneasy relationship since the day he was inaugurated, since the day he was elected. But that became the focal point of what we can, you know, the anger, the chance of reform, and basically just he became the target because of his racist, I would say dog whistle, but it wasn't really like just so certain people could hear. We all could hear the racist, his language, his calls to action from his base. We know who he's talking to and what he's talking about. So that became kind of a centralized point down right at the White House, right at Lafayette Square. And then, you know, he sent his boys out there with rubber bullets and tear gas.
Oh my God.
To do the photo op. I keep saying it's like the worst TikTok video ever created.
Exactly.
And then it became something else. And that symbolized that space. And then our mayor in her eternal wisdom decided she was gonna make a symbol of that space and then put the Black Lives Matter out there.
Amazing.
Which was, I get why it was a symbolic gesture of like, yeah, give it back to him, mayor. You know, stand your ground.
Yes.
I get that.
But I hear a butt coming. I hear a butt coming.
However, the people who know her best, who know her in the city, knows that of those, of her police department's indiscretions and what her police department has been doing around terrorizing and brutalizing Black bodies and Black neighborhoods in this community, that people were like, well, wait a minute. I mean, good. I thank you. We agree with your statement. But in doing that, especially at the center of that miscommunication or non-communication, is the DC affiliate of Black Lives Matter, who she, you know, has no connection with, and doesn't acknowledge much of the Black people here, much of the issues that impact Black people here. There were several, you've seen on my Facebook page, there were several killings of young Black men by police officers, where the mayor doesn't even comment on it, doesn't say anything to the family, doesn't let the family know who, the name of the officer, doesn't allow for an investigation of what happened, and it just kind of goes away, and she just completely ignores much of the city's requests, much of the family's requests to make this information known. So her own record, I guess, on in supporting Black life here in DC has been in question for a while. So for her to do that and play to the cameras was, even though it was a powerful statement, clearly, people who know her best here in the city were a little bit flabbergasted and felt a little bit insulted as to how can you play this role publicly to national media and not atone or at least talk with your local constituents. One example of her kind of, you can call it tunnel vision or whatever it is last fall, St. Elizabeth's Hospital across the river here sits in one of the hardest hit wards in the city. It's a hospital that has long had just structural issues. Water doesn't work. It's just a bunch of different things. It's a psychiatric hospital for the most part.
Okay, psychiatric.
So people with serious mental health or psychiatric issues are there. John Hinckley, the dude that famously shot Reagan back in the day, he was there at one point. So it's like it's a psychiatric hospital, but it provides care. You're there to rehabilitate, to get treatment. It's a hospital.
Right.
But for a month, for more than a month, for more than 30 days in October, I believe it was last year, they had no water. So this not only impacts the inpatients, it impacts the staff, it impacts the surrounding community. They have no water. The people are, disease is being spread. People are like taking showers with water bottles. It's just despicable in the conditions. Now, I don't know, again, this is local news, but in Washington, we got the Washington Mystics, WNBA basketball team, were in the championship last fall. Their stadium is literally right next door to that hospital. Like, you can't, it's not like across the street or down the block, it's literally right next door. Our mayor is in front row of the games that are hosted here, cheering on the team, as we all are, cheering on the Mystics. In the middle of this crisis, she's not answering questions. She's not making any statements. She can't enter the court, the arena, or exit without looking to the left and seeing the hospital. But she says nothing to it about it.
Wow.
Now, the Ward 7 commissioner, former mayor, Vince Gray, is the head of the health committee. Of course, he doesn't say anything either. So it's just kind of this layer upon layer of our city government clearly does not want to acknowledge the concerns of the city's largely Black and brown communities who are maybe a couple of ticks below like the social economic ledge that the mayor seems comfortable with. The mayor is very comfortable in talking with developers. We just had a city council member who was basically kicked off the council because of ethics issues that we know other members have been kind of, dipping their sweet tooth into as well in regards to developers. And you look at where the wealth not just is in the city, but where it's directed in the city. Like, it's one thing to just say generational wealth happens in Georgetown because Georgetown is one of those communities that is born white. It's been around forever. There's wealth there. But then as a mayor, as city council, as city leaders over the last few years, there hasn't been enough to look around the city and wonder, what can we do? Half the city doesn't have access to regular or continuous internet connection. It's the nation's capital. And, you know, the coldest day of this year, our mayor decided she was going to send trucks and people out to just wipe a homeless encampment off the streets because, you know, it looks bad. Wow. So it looked bad to the surrounding neighbors who are in one of those kind of blossoming gentrified spots around the city. So to put it lightly, the mayor doesn't have the best relationship with the entire city. And she's not, though it appears in giant block yellow gold letters down 16th Street near the White House, and the dozens or the several interviews she's done on national media outlets over the last few weeks, she's not the best communicator when it comes to talking to her own city. Wow. And particularly it's black and brown residents and it's poor and low-income residents. And, you know, families still don't have answers despite questionable tactics by her police department in killing their sons. So she won't speak to them, but she'll speak to Anderson Cooper or whoever on CNN, and she will put the big Black Lives Matters out on the street.
Wow.
Even though there are people right here in her city who know that she's got some explaining to do.
She's the exact opposite of Mayor Keisha Bottoms.
Keisha, she's Atlanta?
Uh-huh.
Yes. Yeah. And just to, again, just to add another layer to the interaction, this is what us Washingtonians kind of see in her. Over the summer, or not over summer, it's not a summer yet, over the last, the campaign season, she aligned very publicly with Mike Bloomberg when he was running for president.
Oh, wow.
And she publicly endorsed him despite Bloomberg. And this largely came up because of Bloomberg's stop and frisk
tactics
in New York City, that people here in D.C. were like, well, wait a minute. Well, it made sense because of her philosophies, or clearly her philosophies are of allowing police to do what the hell they want to do here in D.C. because the stop and frisk numbers are horrible as well. And they are, even though, you know, it's totally disproportionately tilted towards, you know, black and brown people being stopped and frisked by police. The numbers all don't lie, but she openly did it. So, and she, again, despite concerns from her own residents, questions about, like, where are you going with this, mayor? She just doesn't respond. She has a very weird communication style when it comes to talking to her own residents.
And it's funny. I didn't even think about it. My cousin was like, I got to work tonight, but I want you to record this. CNN is having the four black mayors. And
not her. Well, oh, yeah, she was one of them. That's right.
She's going to be on there with
Keisha Bottoms,
Lori Lightfoot, and Lord have mercy, Jesus help me, this woman is from here. Well, I can't remember this woman's name. San Francisco, London, London Bree.
Yes, yeah. I just saw the article somewhere, yeah.
So I was like, my cousin was like, it's coming out, and see, it's a funny thing. Y'all at home, y'all know I have issues with the Zoom time standard stuff. So when I send out the stuff to schedule people, I'm always jacking it up. And so as I was sending it to him, I sent Larry the wrong time. Y'all know I jack up. So my cousin was like, it's coming on at 9:00. So I was scrolling through all of 9:00 and I couldn't find this thing. And I was like, it's not here. And then all of a sudden some bell just clicked on. CNN is 3 hours ahead of us. So I jumped back to 6:00 and that's how I was able to finally find it. I was like, we have to get used to that. It's so time thing.
It can be. Yeah. So I'm curious. part of me wants to watch it because I'm curious as to what, I'm less curious as to what our mayor is going to say. Mayor Bowser, I think I've said the mayor, but I haven't actually said her name, Muriel Bowser. I'm curious as to what she's going to be asked.
Okay.
And what, you know, is this going to be a podium, a media created podium that just kind of exalts these four mayors and sheds kind of a real positive light on them, which I don't have a problem with. I get why that can be needed. But I'm also, I know that if it's just essentially a puff piece, then there's going to be a whole bunch of infuriated, like, Washingtonians, like, what, you know, she's going to answer questions. No one's going to really challenge her or anything, you know, especially through what Mayor Bottoms is going through right now.
Yeah.
Did she fire her police chief?
Well, like, the police chief
resigned. She resigned. So, like, I don't know the details in that yet. It's still fresh. But there sounds like there's some accountability there. Like, I don't know if she was asked to resign, I don't know what her record was, the police chief, before resigning. Clearly, it seemed like it was a direct result of the last, like, maybe it had to do with training or something internal that was happening. Her leadership wasn't effective. I don't know what the details were.
But I mean, come on now. We could give this a, that something's clearly wrong, that within, it's got to be within 2 weeks of you just snatching the college kids out the car and tasing them.
Yeah.
You have a police officer kill an unarmed black man all right behind doing this whole something, and you couldn't get your team together? Because I was telling my cousin this, I don't understand how we, in this horrible climate in this country, you as a police officer still think that the first thing to do is grab your gun. He was shooting at you with a taser and he was running, he was drunk, so it wasn't like the taser was gonna hit you, because when he threw it over his arm to shoot it back at you. But here's the other thing I said to my cousin too. You were ill-trained for the job, because how two of you, he was able to get your taser and you guys could not maintain some kind of sense to this whole thing of what was going on. And so that's why I think now it made the chief look crazy, because here your cops are once again in the middle of a situation that it just looks crazy to the world.
It does.
And so best thing for me to do is, the chief, let me resign. Because technically they're going to be knocking at the door saying, you know what, we have to fire you, because it falls on you.
It does. I mean, I'm not going to argue. I can't argue against that. But it also falls on the accountability also falls on the mayor. And so whatever happened there within the details, it happened. But we have similar instances here in D.C. where young men have been killed by the police without any explanation to the families of why or what happened. There have been, last summer, there were multiple, when I say children, I mean young black boys, 8 years old, 10 years old, chased and handcuffed by police for whatever reason. Someone might have stolen a backpack. These three kids fit the description. Let's lock them down here on a major street and sit them on the ground without contacting their parents. This is regular police practices. So, Wow. Again.
And we don't hear about that on the nation, because that's not making national news.
No, but it's
wow.
I did a post. This was the morning of the whole Black Lives Matters print on the street. And I did this thing like, I understand why people are applauding what our mayor is doing with that street and renaming that Black Lives Matters or Black Lives Plaza, whatever it is. I get it. It's a strong visual, especially if you put the days in a row with what the president is doing and saying what's happening around the country. I get that. But let's not go overboard, because we are in D.C. still chanting George Floyd's name, Breonna Taylor's name, and we're not chanting Daquan. Well, actually, we are chanting Daquan Young's name, Terrence Sterling's name, and those are young men killed here without explanation by D.C. police, and the mayor has done nothing about it, but wants to add $18 million to a budget that's already about over a half billion for police officers, as opposed to, you know, correcting what, you know, providing or investing in community-based resources, right? So she's not only not talking about it on a national level, but she's kind of doubling down even more so on the problems that she's considers herself protesting with the art on 16th and H downtown. So when we talk about defund the police, when we talk about defund the police, what we're talking about is not what Minneapolis is doing. I'm curious to see where that ends up. Is we're not talking about disbanding, at least I'm not talking about disbanding the police. I'm talking about, look, there's investments that people are calling for that can create the kind of safety they want to see in their neighborhoods. And those definitions do not include adding more billy clubs, adding more guns, adding more badges, or adding more cops. What it means is adding, you know, violence interrupters, people who live and have intimate connection with different communities around the neighborhood, are trained to know who to talk to, who understand where the stresses are, and can, without guns, without weapons, without a militarized police force, individuals who are trained to kill, by the way, coming in to solve community-based problems. So investing in violence interrupters, investing in trauma services, you know, having people, social workers, mental health professionals, going into communities that can help kind of solve or at least soften, you know, the trauma that families and individuals are feeling after, you know, and just dealing with everyday life or after a killing, whether it's regardless of where the violence is happening or where it's coming from, whether it's police or coming from someone else. Much of the people are in these communities are experiencing some level of generational poverty, are losing jobs. There's a lot of different stress and tension and frustration that is not going to be solved just by putting in more police. Right. So, you know, school-based mental health counselors, you know, one of the provisions of her budget sends more police officers patrolling schools instead of mental health professionals, counselors, investing services and resources in reentry services. You have people, you know, we're already kind of disproportionately putting young Black men in jail anyway. They got to come back out. So let's prepare them, let's train them, job training, mental health counseling, just services that help support their level of independence and security and stability in those same communities. So you can do a lot, or housing, you know, invest in housing services. There's a lot of different substitutes or alternatives that, instead of putting $18 million more into a police budget, we could put that $18 million into the kind of resources that are going to provide safety and security and stability in those communities. Problem is, the people at the mayor's office and those levels aren't even listening to those individuals.
People are saying,
again, this concept is not new. The problem is not new. And the solution seem to be just ignored. But then again, you slide in this performative art show that our mayor put in down the street, it complicates. So it makes it even more infuriating here in DC for residents to see our mayor speaking boldly and loudly outside the city, but pretty much invisible because our policies within the city tend to go the other way.
Yeah, because from what I'm hearing, when everybody else is talking about defunding, she's adding. $18 million, she's adding.
Well, and that's why I'm curious to see how the questions go this afternoon or whenever this thing is going to be aired, because Mayor Bottoms is going to be asked. You just this incident that just happened in your city. Mm-hmm. It's all over the headlines. It's another tragic incident upon another tragic incident in Atlanta. Your police chief has resigned. I personally don't know the details, but I'm suspecting that either her leadership is flawed, like they're not listening to her, or her leadership is flawed in that she's leading them the wrong way. Either way, the mayor decided, or they decided together, however the process went, right, that she had to step down. Lord knows, they're not putting more money into the police department. They might revise their training, they might do some other things, but she's not, I don't know the details of policies in Atlanta, but if the pivot comes to our mayor, like, I don't know how prepared the interviewer is going to be, but there's got to be questions presented to her. You've had similar incidents in your city, Mayor Bowser, where young Black men have been killed by police, and there hasn't been really any transparency in regards to the investigation. You have seen residents who are still, the families of the deceased, of the murdered young men, who are still looking for answers as to what happened and why. There's numerous accounts of stop and frisk and racial profiling data that the ACLU, where I work, and others have compiled and gathered over the last couple of years. You know, there are a number of other incidents where people, it didn't lead to someone's death, but it led to illegal searches. It led to just kind of racist profiling. It leads to a lot of different things. How will she answer that? And it sounds like, and because it's all over the media, all over the internet, certainly, like, it sounds like you're adding $18 million to a problem that seems to be spiraling out of control. How do you answer that, Mayor Bowser?
That's going to put her in the hot seat if they ask that question.
And because she's ignoring local media. Yeah, she's ignoring the local media.
Right, because she could also get on there and say, I'm only answering these questions. You know, people send prescribed questions, that this is the only ones that you can do. If it's not this, I don't answer anything else. Mm-hmm. And that's the question for her. We should be like, well, what does the police, defunding the police really mean to you if you're doing the opposite? Because people really want to know if there's a way to change the system. Because people say police reform, they say that didn't work, they've tried training, they've given them, cameras on the vest cameras, that's still not working. So,
Hold on, but the reason why a lot of that isn't working isn't because the tool of itself isn't working, it's because there's no accountability in using it. Like, police officers should be penalized if they turn off if they have any unaccounted time where they turn off their body-worn camera. And any footage should be, especially when it's wrapped around an incident, a violent incident or an arrest or whatever, that it's a part of evidence. And if the family of the individuals who have been killed, in this case, Daquan or Terrence, those families should have the right to see what happened.
Full footage.
But all of a sudden, there's no accountability to the police being, they don't show the video, they don't give up the data, the research. The police department is like the mafia here. They do what the hell they want to when they want to. And there's no real level of accountability, and the mayor supports that kind of, you know, that, you know, she is not putting any pressure on the police department. If anything, she supports what they do, and they feel, the police department feels that they have her total support. And her budget increase doesn't just echo that support, it doubles down on it. So again, it's, there are things that legislatively can be put into play, but if there's no accountability, if there's no follow-up, if there's no transparency in the process, and if there's no penalizing these, whether it's MPD, the police department, the mayor's office, or whomever, if there's no accountability placed on it, then people can write laws all day long. But if they're not being enforced, even if it's the police department,
right,
then it doesn't matter. And she seems to be in support of, you know, do what I say, don't question what I do kind of mentality.
So now, what are your thoughts about defunding? Are you for defunding? Are you against defunding?
I am for investing or providing resources, investing in community-based services. I'm in support of listening to your community members and identifying what those needs are. It might, the conversation might just start with a question. What is safety to you? How do you define safety? There's going to be people that see it in different ways. We need to start with the conversation of listening to community members, listening to residents, being able to identify what is safety, and then give those options. We have, you know, more conservative place people here in DC, many of them Black people, who automatically identify safety as, hey, we need more cops. That's largely because they've been either trained to say that, or it's just been passed down through generations, like the cops are what we do, or the council member in that community just says, hey, I'm for cops, I like you, you're for cops too, right? But there's a larger group of people who understand that safety, when you're taking money, when you're cutting mental health resources in schools, when you're cutting job training programs, when you're closing medical facilities, when you're disbanding or shutting down hospitals and other maternal care services in parts of the city, and filling all those empty voids, empty spaces up with police officers, to me, that doesn't seem to be the clear-cut definition. We need to provide the resources. We don't send cops up in Georgetown. We don't send them to Upper Northwest. The people in Upper Northwest aren't asking for more police. They already feel safe. You know why? Because they have bike lanes and dog parks. They have, you know, the social services. They have all the things that make their communities nice and soft and safe and comfortable. Black communities, brown communities have the same rights to be able to identify and define what and how safety is defined for them. So I'm all for reallocating those funds that would, again, expand one of the biggest budgets, police budgets in the country. Like I said, it's almost, you know, more than $500 million already, just to add 18 more million that could go so many other different places and directly draw a direct line between what is safety and the outcomes that come from that for the residents there. And I'm guessing there's a lot of cities around the country who would think and feel the same way. Like I said, I was living in Brooklyn, you know, for 6 years, and it's a lot of similar challenges there, you know, different neighborhoods being gentrified, and some of the community-based interventions are kind of being phased out because the new people that come in there have a completely different idea of what safety means to them. And we need more cops because we got dangerous people out in the streets. And then you look out the street and you just see Black and brown people. Like, well, like a couple of years ago when I was living in Brooklyn, there was a young man who had some serious mental health issues. And he, because of lack of treatment options, those serious mental health issues came to the surface more than once or twice. Like, he couldn't go and just get a therapist, or he couldn't always take his meds or get his meds. He couldn't always find mental health care, quality mental health care. So he would have occasional episodes where he would be outside in his favorite intersection and he'd have a metal pipe or bar, and he would wave it at people who didn't hurt anyone, but he was just, the people who knew him, and they could calm him down, or they could at least, exist with him without any dangerous interactions. Uh-huh. Some new people move into the neighborhood. They see a black man they don't identify out waving what looks like a gun or something. You have police officers who aren't familiar with the community that are called to intervene, and they don't have any history or interaction with this gentleman. They immediately are frightened, I guess. They shoot him dead. He doesn't have a gun. He's not killing anyone. He's not hurting anyone. He's just having one of his serious mental health episodes. That's part gentrification. You have new people coming in, redefining the culture and the norms of that community and the interventions in that community. That's, racial profiling. I see a black man. He doesn't sound literate. He doesn't sound composed. He must be dangerous. Let's call a police officer. Police officer shows up, not trained, not familiar with the community, has no connection or commitment to learning the community, shows up without conversation, maybe not properly trained for incident de-escalation. So he shows up and shoots the guy. So there's a lot of things there. And that starts with, if you put the investments in the right place, that situation doesn't happen. That gentleman is getting mental health care if he's not, you can identify where he needs to go. That's a simple example of how reallocating support services, more police wouldn't have kept this man alive. Police wouldn't have made this guy or that community any more safe. Mental health resources, trauma, de-escalation tactics and training, trauma informed service and care would have been far more valuable, and that he would have still been alive.
Wow, that is something. That is something. And so that's to say, defunding and moving the money into places where they could be very well beneficial. And I said this to my cousin, I talk all the time. The situation where we just had the young lady who slapped the white lady in Arizona. Mm-hmm. And the next day the husband got on and his words was, 2 years ago, this wouldn't happen. She has anxiety. She has medical stuff that's coming on. And I told my cousin, I said, this really falls back on the Republicans. Because when Ronald Reagan was in office, he shut down the mental health programs. They defunded all of those programs back then. So now you want to use the stuff that's not here no more.
Yeah, well, yeah, true. However, I wouldn't apply that particular situation for that.
We know it. We know
he was just rationalizing for his wife.
Yeah.
That's all that was.
Yeah. But I'm like, now, so if that's the case, then if we would still have these hospitals, and then let's put your butt in this hospital. You need to go serve some time in there. But we don't have them no more because the Republicans said they wasn't necessary. But now y'all want to use them in this situation. You want to play on it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a system. I mean, maybe defund or divest aren't words people are comfortable with. They sound too heavy. They sound too, permanent, I guess. I don't know. Reallocate funds, invest. One of my coworkers has created the hashtag invest in black communities, instead of divest from police departments. How about invest? We need to be talking about the outcomes. People say defund, divest. their fear, they get distracted by that fear. Like, what do you mean you're going to take the police department away? Like, who's going to keep us safe? What we need to focus on is the outcome. The outcomes we want to see. And if the outcome we want to see is investments in community-based services, supports, interventions, then that means the money you're going to put in the police department that's adding to the terror and stress and murders in your neighborhood, maybe put that money over here. So reallocating those funds. Maybe that's a simpler term that people can identify with. But we need to focus on the change we want to see. Now, granted, there are groups out there who are abolitionists by their core. Like they don't want to see anybody in a police uniform ever. And you know, I have friends who are abolitionists, and you know, talk about your outcomes. Like it's for people like me or anyone else. It can be scary to talk about, hey, we just want the police to be gone. Talk about what you want to see in their place. Like what are the alternatives to safety that you want to see, and how can we put meaningful investments to making that happen?
Because you can't just fund them. Yeah. If you,
yeah, you can't just wipe the slate clean and think people are gonna say, okay, now what? You gotta give people a roadmap. So for me personally, I will say that, you know, all police officers aren't racist. All police officers aren't sexist. All police officers aren't, you know, terrorists and murderers. Now there are some that have proven that on camera again and again. Police officers can be useful and a meaningful, supportive part of protecting a community. However, we still need the accountability from them when they make mistakes, and that they're able to call out those who fit those categories. And we need to reallocate support services and money, real investments, into the community-based services and supports that truly keep us safe. And those communities know who they are. There are hundreds of community-based organizations around the country that are doing a ton of work, meeting eye to eye, face to face, hand to hand with their community members, and know what safety means. That those people, those provisions need to be resourced. Those interventions, those supports need to be invested in. Throwing more police officers into a mix, a volatile mix that's already, you know, challenged and imbalanced, and again, adding guns, adding batons, adding badges, adding more trained murderers, trained killers into a mix and say that that's going to make you safe, is not the answer for everybody. Certainly not the answer in DC.
So, definitely that. So when people, I want you guys at home to get this too. Just because we say, and I love the reallocate, we say that everybody thinks that there's gonna be less police. And truthfully, if you really be truthful, sometimes it could be less police, but it would make the other police who are sitting around not doing anything, it would cause them to work more. And I honestly say, I think in my entire life, I probably have only ever had to call 911 once in my entire life. So if you're worried about feeling safe, how many times do you really pick up and call 911 for them to come out where you felt like there was a situation where you needed to call? So if the money was reallocated to something else by having more community centers in your neighborhood where the kids were places where they could hang out and there were people there, you would have more community support instead of corners where there's just nothing on that corner. There's no business there. The building has been vacant for 5,000 years. Some type of community organization could be in that building because there would be funds to put them there. And then you would feel safer because you wouldn't be walking by an abandoned building or a deserted building. Somebody would be there, which when there's more people, I guess I say this the best way, when there's more people in the community out doing stuff, you should feel safe when you see more. I think
That's not necessarily true. You talk about calling 911. So one, there's a lot of people here in DC and in New York and in Brooklyn and in other places, I'm sure, where people are terrified to call 911 because you don't know who's going to show up. And what are you calling 911 for? Like, if you see, if someone's having a serious mental health issue, there are a lot of people in New York that tell you, or here in DC, that tell you, don't call 911. If someone having a breakdown, don't call 911. You're going to get shot. They don't know how to de-escalate that kind of situation.
Well, I call because the car, my car had been broken into. So that was when I think about when I've only actually, I had to really think hard, how many times have I actually had to call 911? And it's really only once.
But the idea of calling the police for anything should be a very limited and kind of a very limited, very kind of exclusive and severely dangerous or very specific kind of reason, right? Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of reasons why we call 911. And I heard this quote, I've heard this quote many times from police officers, like sitting in like PTA meetings or sitting in like community meetings or advisory neighborhood commission meetings here in DC, where the police officer is talking about different stuff is or incident that happened in a neighborhood. And they're like, look, we're not social workers. We come out and we try to keep people safe. I say, when you hear a police officer say, we're not social workers, we're not mental health professionals, and they say it, at least the times I've heard it, they say it in this way, like, look, this isn't our thing. We don't do this.
Right.
Listen to them and then hire a social worker.
Exactly.
So that's what the defund, divest, you know, movement is. That's what reallocating money is. The police officers, they're not trained to do that. In New York, again, I work for NAMI in New York, where we were a part of the discussion around training police officers to be mental health providers, to be able to deal with or manage situations and interactions with people who on the subways, in the streets, in their homes, who are experiencing serious mental health issues. And there's been, we've seen and heard and read number of cases where men and women who are having serious mental health issues are instead being shot by police officers who felt like they were just weren't equipped to deal with the situation. And then you have movements in entire cities where, like, if you see someone having a breakdown, don't call the police because they don't know what they're doing. And then we should hire social workers, mental health, we should invest in meaningful mental health work that can help people who are having serious mental health issues. We don't need our police officers to be counselors. We don't need them to be in our schools. We don't need them to be in walking like gangs five deep through our neighborhoods. We don't need them stopping us on the streets, asking us where our IDs are, or what are you doing out here, or why aren't you at work? We don't need that. What we need are the things that keep us strong in our communities. We need job training programs. We need, you know, to invest in after-school programs. We need the things that make our families and individuals and our Black bodies and brown bodies safe and secure. Cops, let's let them do what they do, and we will call them when they need them. I mean, I'm curious to see in Minneapolis how they're disbanding. I'm not sure the exact language they're using. Disbanding of the Minneapolis Police Department. What how that's going to look, what that's going to look like going forward. I think that's going to be a very interesting kind of case, like a model of what reimagining safety looks like. You know, several universities and schools have already said, yeah, we're cutting our contracts with the police. We don't need police officers. We're going to find alternative sources of safety and patrol or whatever we need to do here. So for the city of doing, I mean, Minneapolis is not, it's not Brooklyn, it's not DC, it's not Oakland, but I'm curious to see how that looks and what that's going to look like going forward. Because that could be a model, maybe not to that extent, but there could be varying degrees of what they're doing in Minneapolis, assuming that it works out well, that you could see modeled through other communities, other major cities in the country.
And for those of you in the Bay Area, really, just taking just a little bit of the funds could help the Bay Area schools, because in the Bay Area schools, we have officers, but we don't have school nurses.
Ooh.
So when you say that it's not a good thing, why does your school not have a school nurse, but you have a police officer and your child gets sick and they sit your child in a former nurse's office that used to be an office with it's a storage room now, and your child sits there until either you come pick them up, your husband, your spouse, or whoever, the babysitter, and there's not a nurse there. And they're just sitting there in a room. But a police officer who is contracted through school has an office, has everything going on, and they're sitting there and they can't help your child during that situation. So that,
and no one does a child want them, because in a lot of cases, I know I can speak here in DC, that just seeing police officers, seeing someone in the uniform, seeing a car, hearing those bloop bloop, like, you know, all of that is triggering and traumatic for people who live in those communities where cops are, like, you know, are deep. So it just adds to the generational trauma that children and families continue to be pounded with in those communities. Like, yeah, we don't think as much of you to have someone trained to close your cut, but we're going to send a cop in because this is what we really think about you.
Exactly.
That's what it is.
And it's crazy. It is really crazy. And so for police officers who are worried about being defunded, the best suggestion I can give, and I know that Larry has a way better one than me. Mine starts with this. Do your job properly, and then they won't have to get rid of you. Do the job the way that you're supposed to be required to protect and serve. Because if they start to defund, then they can go through and start saying your actions are not aligned up with what this job is supposed to be doing. So we have to let you go because we're here to serve the community. At least I thought that's what we were here to do. But Larry can tell y'all better that. He can break it down. He speaks more eloquently than I do.
No, actually, that was perfect. The first thing in my mind was, you know, what to tell a police officer whose future might be in jeopardy. Be better. Just be better. But, you know, be better. I think police departments, and again, I work for the ACLU DC. I am not a lawyer. I'm not a law enforcement, like, analyst or professional. But I live in communities that are, you know, saturated with police officers. And I think I have some lived experience with some of this. Is that be better if we're going to hire, if police departments are going to continue to exist, the hiring process, hiring people who have history with their or connections with their communities. You know, when you have the gentrification and the external recruitment that our city does, like, if we see it all over our internet, like, we're basically advertising to the rest of the country, if not the world, hey, if you want to be a police officer, come here. We are advertising to the rest of the world about new developments and apartment communities and just you know, work life in DC. We're literally recruiting our own gentrification into existence. But if we're going to hire cops, if we're going to train cops, then we need to do more to build a connection within our community. So hire cops from Southeast instead of Iowa. You know, train our cops, build community connections in ways that is meaningful and support the community, not the police department, that support the community. The community's priorities should be the ones that are listed at the top. But at this point in time, I don't think we don't need to hire any more police officers. DC is one of these unique jurisdictions as well, that there are so, we have so many jurisdictions that intersect in the city. So we have DC local police, we have Capitol Police, we have the Secret Service, we have National Park Police. Wow. There are so many different FBI, CIA, we have all of that kind of intersects around the communities, and depending on where you are in the city, you are in one or all jurisdictions. So we have an abundance, never mind just MPD, our local police department, there's an abundance of badges and guns around the city all the time. So, but despite the federal police and the things that are outside local, our Metropolitan Police Department already has a budget that's over $500 million. They are continually adding to it. And the most recent budget proposal coming from the mayor is again to add another $18 million to that. We don't need that. Those are resources that can go in places that will add and lead to more meaningful reform and definitions of safety in the communities that most need it and most want it.
Wow, that's a lot. That's a lot. So people at home, I really want y'all to get this part. The conversation needs to be had about, if y'all want to continue to use the word defund the police, if that's what y'all want to be. But there are just ways that this can be done, and we're not saying, now some places are, now I'm here, and how he just said that they have all these different cops. In our area, I think we see, in the Bay Area, you guys see the local city cop, and then you see the California Highway Patrol who goes in and patrols. Now, you heard him say, you fall into a jurisdiction where it could be the FBI, it could be this, the CIA, it could be the Secret Service, it could be the local Metro cop, the DC cop. Boy, if y'all had that many cops here in the Bay Area, y'all would go crazy.
And that's just the boots on the ground, so to speak. We got like Amazon is building a big nest across the river. So the idea of like surveillance tools and all kinds of digital spying and
drones, the thing that they're talking about,
facial recognition technology. All of that is expanding. That's part of the law enforcement. That's a part of when we say defund police, This is part of it. We don't need facial recognition technology in public spaces. Again, especially because it's a digital way of just profiling in the traditional way.
Yes.
So it complicates it, and it just adds additional harm to those who are already experiencing harm in those communities. So we need to start listening to those communities who are hardest hit by police involvement, police interactions, and start listening to what true forms of alternative forms of safety is, and in doing the best we can to fund and invest in things that we already know. Again, mental health counselors in schools, job training, housing. There's just so many things that help keep us safe that have nothing to do with guns, billy clubs, badges, and guns.
And for y'all that, I know y'all stay mad at me because I say this all the time, y'all stay mad at me. You have to vote. I can't stress that enough. I can't say it enough. You have to vote because whether you want to admit it, it still affects you, and it affects you negatively if you don't vote in your local races.
I'm glad you added that part of it. Because we're all looking forward to voting in November to get this motherfucker this dude out the White House. So that's I cannot wait until that day. But our local elections, in a lot of cases, are more important because our local elected leaders are more directly connected to our concerns, our issues, and our problems. And that's where we can make the change first, and then it goes up. Don't worry. I trust all y'all gonna be on show up on November 2nd, first Tuesday in November. I trust everyone's gonna show up then.
Do you believe that?
I have no choice but to believe that.
Do you think we're gonna get him out?
I have no doubt that he will not be reelected. I'm just gonna say it that simply. Now, the person that's elected in his place, the shit doesn't stop with this guy. We still need to make sure that these reforms and these changes and these improvements in our local and national conversation and communities still happen. Biden has his own record, his own flaws and challenges. He's not the guy that's in office now, but let's not just assume he's going to save us.
He's not. I hate to say this, but I believe that Biden will be a one-term president.
I think all he needs to be is a one-term president. I think it's very important who he picks as a vice president.
Very, very important. I think that can destroy him if he picks wrong.
Right. And I think that choice alone makes his candidacy worth it. Like, let's not just vote this dude out because he's horrible. Let's make sure who we're putting in there has some substance that we can work with. And if it's Biden, we can, he's cast. His die is cast. We know who he is. He listens. He's going to move to a certain degree to the voices he hears. And he's always going to, we know he has like important friends in his ear occasionally. But who he picks as a vice president and how he shapes the future beyond him is going to be hugely important. And because we know he's listening, he's paying attention, we have the capacity to help provide that influence. Obama was elected the first time, I initially thought that Hillary Clinton would get that nomination and she would pick Biden as his running mate. And then we would have, maybe two terms of Hillary Clinton and then maybe two terms of Barack Obama. I was a little bit surprised that Obama picked Biden because Biden doesn't speak to future. And there wasn't a whole lot built that once Obama left office, that there was a natural next step. It could have been Hillary, but Hillary felt like she was going to get a lifetime achievement award instead of actually earning the election. And she did her campaign basically like it was a lifetime achievement award because she didn't take her candidate seriously. And then, she had her run-ins with Bernie Sanders, and then she just wasn't a favorite of people.
Right.
But going forward, I hope Biden not just makes, his own name and space for his own name going forward, but that his running mate and his policies are truly speaking to beyond his term. Because that's what we're talking about. This is not just a break in the action. We need to grab the steering wheel moving forward with progressive ideas, with inclusive ideas, and we need to find solutions that include all of the voices in this country not just the people who think they know best. There are so many people on the ground, there are so many experiences in this country that add to all of us moving forward, not just some of us or certain parts of us for certain private or personal or just selfish reasons. We can be better, and we can, I think, influence this candidate's decisions going forward. We should not stop what we're doing right now to make that happen.
Now, your ear is on the ground way more than mine is. Is there a person out there that we should be pushing for 2020 that should be a vocal person, that should be for the Democratic Party, that should be standing up with the issues that everybody has on their concern? Is there somebody now that's in the rankings moving up that we don't, that we may not know about here on the West Coast, that's on the East Coast there?
Are you talking about for like vice president?
For even going into 2020 as president.
Well, I mean, I think we have our candidate. So Joe Biden is probably going to be the candidate. I don't think
we're going to move on past. Let's move on past.
What are you talking about, like even beyond him?
Yeah.
I think his choices, or his options rather, for vice president, I think they're key. You're talking about like, you know, Kamala Harris.
They heard that on the screen.
Yeah, one of those people. She's not the favorite of everyone, but she's one of those people. Stacey Abrams is another choice, another option.
I think she's a great option.
Right. I saw recently that former Ambassador Susan Rice was being talked about as one of those candidates, one of those possible candidates. Mm-hmm. I mean, any of the, we need to think about progressive, we need to think about the next 10 years, next 20 years, mm-hmm, of this country and policies and politics and who this candidate will motivate and speak to. Not just as a figurehead or as like the carbon cutout of like, hey, I'm with her. Biden likes to do with Obama. Like, I like black people clearly because I'm friends with Obama. So like, that's, you know, eventually like something. So I don't know, those candidates, I mean, I'm willing to guess there's probably some young members of the House of Representatives, young members of Congress, young upcoming elected officials around the country, either of color, who have a far more diverse and developed sense of self, of sense of community, an understanding of what progression means, actual progression means, in regards to poverty, social justice, social issues, and equality. As long as we're thinking along those parameters, I mean, there are, I'm not willing to settle on just the kind of the popular four or five names that are out there. I'm sure they can all contribute something, you know, in their space and time in office, or even not in office, just in life in general. But I want to think deeper. I hope that the people who are kind of charged with doing those, that kind of vetting, that kind of thinking, are first thinking about the type of candidate, the type of person to fit that role first, and then looking out there to see who fits those qualities, as opposed to doing it the other way around. Like, I like Kamala Harris. She's a black woman. I'm going to make her fit into the box that I see that's successful. This is nothing against Kamala Harris or any of the current like front runners, but we can't just see the name and see the face and then apply our sensibilities on him or her. We have to think about who it is we want to see in that role and then go out, because we might find a lot of other names, a lot of other people who far better represent that level of progress, that level of commitment to equity, commitment to social justice, commitment to kind of lifting all of our voices, I think we'll see a lot more success doing it that way instead of trying to fit people or fit our, you know, alliances and allegiances in a box that they may not be comfortable with.
Ah, there you have it. That's the truth.
I mean, that's kind of what happened to Mayor Pete, right?
Yes.
I mean, a lot of people saw him as this, wow, he looks the part and he has certain check boxes, but when you hear him speak, it was like, oh, he's not, well, no, he's got to be, right? Because he fits my box. But no. And the more we heard about him, the more we realized he just wasn't ready. Now, this is not a knock on him or other candidates. He's still young, he can grow, but we need to think about the qualities we want to see first and then go from there instead of looking at a face and starting there.
But now, do you also think America would have voted in a same gender loving president?
If that same gender loving president can speak not just for him or herself, but can speak to marginalized communities all over this country about hope, about progress, about meaningful and concrete change that frees us all from poverty, that frees us all from the oppressive systems that we're currently in now. If that candidate can speak to the country and can provide like clear, concrete, and somewhat inspirational like motivations for a future, for a progressive future that includes all of us, why not? I would.
Wow.
I mean, he might not have been the guy. There, you know, people we're naming now may not be fit that role, but if you're only voting against them or not voting for them because of their sexuality, then that's on us.
But you know, there are so many people who do vote just because of that.
Yeah, and those same people vote for Trump.
And they vote for Trump, exactly.
So, and as I like to say, that the people who are his base are not new. These aren't new people. No. Trump didn't show up in 2016 and all of a sudden he brought a whole new groups of people to him and voted for him. Less people voted for Trump than voted for Mitt Romney or John McCain before him.
Yes.
People forget Donald Trump got less votes, less total votes than Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
McCain and Romney before him lost historically to Barack Obama. The reason why Donald Trump won is less because of who he was speaking to and who voted for him, but it was all those people that just didn't vote at all and didn't vote previously for Obama, who didn't vote for Hillary Clinton, didn't vote Democratic. So it's not about outsmarting this dude. It's about finding people we can trust. And in this case, it's about identifying the candidates who speak to our issues, who offer solutions, who ask questions when more information is needed, who's willing to learn on the job, and who's willing to speak and at least advocate for all of us. That's fairly simple. I don't need you to, if your allegiance to big business, that's not gonna do it. You know, a lot of the people who appear to be great candidates on their cover photo all of a sudden become less ideal as you read their timeline. Yes. So and that's the candidates we need. We need the candidates that I can learn and who's interested in learning me.
True that. Now I got to go back and just ask you one little small question about that old good old Trump thingy there. Because we know that less people voted, but wouldn't the Electoral College had a lot to also do with that? They picked him.
Yeah, I mean it's how it's drawn up. He won the right jurisdictions, like I guess, and it's those lines are drawn and redrawn as politics and politicians see fit because they want to enhance their chances of winning. It's like I'm a sports fan, so it's like if I want my football team to win, then I recreate or transform my field so it benefits my players, not yours, as opposed to we're all on the equal field. So we need to have more of that, you know, reform electoral policies. I think that should be high on all of our agendas going forward, both locally and nationally, making sure that the electoral process, the election process itself, the voting process itself, is a clean and clear and transparent process that's open to anyone and everyone. And that we're not, you know, voter suppression is real, and we need to fight against that and fight hardest in the places where it's happening the most, most often.
So there you guys have it. I hope that you have learned something today, because I have learned something as usual. If you don't know, you have to ask somebody who does. You have to go out and get those who are in the trenches, who are down in the ground. They work in there. They're doing the community support, which we all should be doing. We really should be a part of our community. But we're always not that. So you can
Sometimes it just means listening. That's all. Just pull up a chair and listen.
And listen.
We all have a soapbox. Sometimes we need to just sit down and listen.
Yes. You can find Larry Bryan Jr. on Facebook. You can find him there. And I promise you, if you just watch his posts, you'll learn something. I promise you. I guarantee you Christopher Terrence Jones endorses that. I'm 100% behind it all the way. I'm going to endorse him all the way. So thank you guys for listening. Hope that you enjoy. Please make sure that you comment, like, share, all of that good stuff. And email me if you have any questions. We would love to have him come back and talk more, because there's another topic that I want him to come back and talk about. So I'm going to be like, hey, can I get you to come back? You guys have a great week. Continue to social distance. Stay safe. I promise you. Stay in the house. It's not time to go out yet. Stay safe. Wear your mask. Do all of that good stuff. Peace out. You guys have a great week.